Hello, everybody. You have tuned into From the Hip Radio with Joe Dockery, a weekly podcast where you will hear great music, thoughtful commentary, and compelling interviews, along with features addressing a wide variety of subjects. From the Hip Radio will not only entertain, but Joe will encourage us all to appreciate the immense beauty that our life's journey together has to offer.
Well, thank you, Mary Lynn, and welcome, everyone, to podcast number 12. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Tiffany Ray Fisher. She's the director of New York City's Elisa Monte Dance. We'll talk about the world of dance, Tiffany's career path, and what led her to the position of artistic director and choreographer of this prestigious New York City modern dance company. We'll also discuss race and race relations in America. And, in light of our focus on dance, I thought I'd just fill the show with dance tunes from all over the world. Let's start with a song called Chanda Mama. It comes from the incredible music series Playing for Change. These are basically street musicians and singers from different parts of the world who have all been recorded on site with headphones, listening and playing to previously dubbed musicians and singers. Okay, now, these are dance tunes, so I want you to get up and dance to these songs. That's right, get a workout today. And if you're too shy to dance, then just move something. Don't just sit there and listen. I want you to immerse yourself in these rhythms and become part of the celebration of life.
Chanda mama, chanda mama, revaya.
Again, that's Chanda Mama from the music series Playing for Change. Now, if you're not familiar with Playing for Change, please look it up on YouTube. Better yet, become a member and support this incredible organization. When you search Playing for Change on YouTube, you absolutely must start with the very first recording that they did. Search Playing for Change, Stand By Me. The point of these videos and the mission of this organization is that world peace can be achieved through music. Yes, that's how powerful these videos are. And the videos have become so popular that many major artists just had to be involved. Keith Richards, Bono, Peter Gabriel, Ringo Starr, Jimmy Buffett, Keb Mo, Taj Mahal, and even Yo-Yo Ma make appearances in these videos. But it's those early videos, the ones with nothing but no-name artists, that are the most powerful. The videos begin with one person playing an instrument and singing, laying down the basic track. The producers then take this recording, and they travel the world to get street musicians, you know, people who are just playing for change on the street, who then lay down one more instrument and then another into the mix. And as they go from one country to the next, from one musician to the next, they cross cultural and religious borders, and soon you realize how universally powerful music can be. And that if we could only look beyond the politicians who wield their power to wage war for personal or corporate gain, there you find the rest of us. The rest of us who, if we had it our way, would simply strive to get along. And music would be at the forefront of the weapons used to gain that lofty goal. Now, I'd play that song for you, but you just need to see it for yourself to get the full impact. Again, search Playing for Change, Stand By Me. Hey, but in the meantime, get up, because here's another universal truth we can all get behind.
Sugar and care, so
And, of course, those are the Blues Brothers with that incredible band. So let's keep it going. This tune was written by Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli way back in 1937. But since then, it has been recorded by so many others, from big bands as well as bluegrass musicians. Here's the Boilermaker Jazz Band out of Pittsburgh, led by Paul Cosentino, with their version of Minor Swing. Boilermaker Jazz Band with the classic Minor Swing. Now we're going to head to the southwest of the United States. Here's the great Tex-Mex singer Selena blending a bit of reggae with her classic Tejano sound with a song that she wrote about how a woman's heart sounds when her man walks by. Here's the great live version of Bitty Bitty Bom Bom.
Y me empieza escucha esta canción, mi corazón quiere cantar así.
Okay, now I know that's a little silly, but I just had to give Selena some airtime. Now, let's head to Uganda and a song from the incredibly popular young star Eddie Kenzo with his infectious sound and Palalawe, which means let's go. And that's Ugandan artist Eddie Kenzo with Palalawe. Let's go. Now, let's bring things back to Detroit. Here's one of my favorites from 1966. I was just starting to play drums and was keen on the top 40 at that time. The Supremes and Can't Hurry Love.
I need love, love, to ease my mind. I need to find someone to call mine. But mama said, you can't hurry love. No, you just have to wait. She said, love don't come easy. It's a game of give and take. You can't hurry love. No, you just have to wait. You gotta trust, give it time. No matter.
The Supremes and Can't Hurry Love. Now that was a great series of dance tunes. I sure hope you took advantage of it and got up and moved. So that leads me into my interview with artistic director and choreographer Tiffany Ray Fisher of the Elisa Monte Dance Company. Tiffany is now in her 17th year with this internationally acclaimed dance troupe. She joined the company in 2004 and quickly became its principal dancer, and is now in her fifth season as artistic director. Also, as a faculty member at Steps on Broadway, Tiffany trains both professional and pre-professional dancers in classes that push them to foster their creative mind and increase their physical endurance. Tiffany has a long list of teaching credits, having been invited to head workshops at many universities throughout the country. Recently, she's been commissioned by the Dance Theater of Harlem to create a piece for their celebration of the Harlem Renaissance Centennial. And in 2018, Tiffany was awarded a citation from the City of New York recognizing her cultural contributions. So I'm sitting in my office with Tiffany Ray Fisher, who is the artistic director for the Elisa Monte dance troupe. And I can't tell you how excited I am to be here speaking with you, Tiffany, because your dance troupe has been so inspiring to me as we've had two opportunities to see the performance at the Lake Placid Center for the Arts. So, Tiffany, thanks so much for coming on From the Hip Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to be here as well. So
now, as artistic director of Elisa Monte Dance, you're also the choreographer, right? I mean, those are your duties. You're the choreographer. So what we see is what you're trying to express as an art, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I took over as artistic director 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And as we were leading up to it, it has been a single voice choreography company. So the founder, Elisa Monte, it was her voice. she was married to a dancer, and so it became the Monty Brown. David Brown was also a dancer in Graham. They met in Graham. They formed the company. So it was the two of them. After they separated, it became Elisa's vision and voice for about 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. And when she decided she wanted to retire, she wanted it to again be a single like voiced company. So what we did is leading up to it so that people would get a sense of my aesthetic, my voice, is that we would do 80% of Elisa's work, 20% of mine. The next season we would do 50-50. And then right before I took over, we switched it. So it was 80% of the program was my work, 20% was Elisa's, so that people could get used to my aesthetic. And it's I was with the company for many years, for about 12 years as a dancer. So a lot of what was in my body and how I learned to choreograph was through Elisa, but it was also, that was not my first company. It happened mm-hmm. to be my last company, but it wasn't the first company, but I'm
let's
happy
go back.
To...
You had mentioned Graham, and of course, yes. You know, and everybody in dance would know who that is, but our listeners may not. I imagine that you are referring to Martha Graham, correct?
Yes. So the founder of Elisa Monte Dance was a principal dancer with the Martha Graham Company.
Elisa Monte herself was
Elisa
a principal
Monte.
Dancer with the Martha Graham Company. There
yes.
we go. All right.
And David Brown was her partner at the time. And they
and when
were
was
both.
This? When? What years were this? Like early
this
70s?
In the 70s,
or?
Yes. Because okay. Elisa Monte Dance was established in 1981, and the first piece that Elisa ever created with David Brown was Treading, which was created in 79.
And then, so if you could just give us a little bit of history on her journey then through Martha Graham into Elisa Monte.
Yeah, so what's interesting, I think, about Elisa is that the Graham technique is very, very specific, and there's a lot of people that have come out of the Graham technique, and you really see that, like, this is from Graham. I think with Elisa, because she has such an expansive, her talent was quite expansive, and I think just her interests were very expansive, she kind of took the best of all of these different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
She had a loft in, and still has a loft in New York that she would rent out to artists. So when Palabolas was beginning, they would come and rent out and she would choreograph with them. So there's a lot of like partnering in her work. There is the theatricality of Graham, but it's not rigid. She really created her own style that mm-hmm. really differentiates her and separates her from others that have come through the Graham Company. And she was a mentee of Alvin Ailey.
Mm-hmm.
So Alvin Ailey, that was her first commissioned work. So she was, you know, she, as far as kind of dance pedigree goes, it's kind of crazy.
Oh gosh, it's very impressive.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back. Boy, you know, I want to talk about Palabolas. I certainly want to talk about Alvin Ailey, and it's leading right into you. But let's go back with Martha Graham now. What was her technique? Was that a style of movement that would characterize her?
Yeah. So with modern dance, they're what we call the major moderns. And Martha Graham would be one of the major moderns. So when modern dance was being formed, and modern dance was kind of created as a counter to ballet, modern dance is a American art form. It wasn't created in the courts of France. It was very much a reaction to what was going on and had a very naturalistic bent. It was done with bare legs. It was done with bare feet, which was very different from what people had experienced from what was coming out of the courts in Europe. And so the people that have started this new type of movement and actually were able to turn it into organizations, meaning like dance companies, and monetize it and market it and put it out there. We have like Jose Limon was one of the like major moderns. Martha Graham was like one of the major moderns. It really has to stay within a certain vocabulary. Very similar to ballet. And as you get into contemporary modern starts to get more stylized, which I think is really interesting. It allows for evolution of the art form in a way that others can't. When you're working with ballet, you're working with a very specific vocabulary, a very specific known movement vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you step outside of that, it becomes something else. With modern dance, it's not that. Modern dance, I like to say, is kind of the naming of names. There's always a modern dance in any school that you go to. There's like a modern dance tree that looks like a family tree, but it's showing who's going to this person, who was linked to this person, who went on to do that. And I think that's one of the reasons I really loved modern dance, is because you can kind of track it back, and it's because it's an American art form. It made me feel very patriotic in a very odd way. It was the first thing that made me feel quite patriotic, because it was an American art form.
Right.
And really beautiful.
We were talking with Bruce Rao, who's an instructor here at North Country Community College, about Walt Whitman, and about how Walt Whitman was not the first American poet. However, he was the first American poet that just broke all of the rules and began to write in a very American way. He began speaking very personally about himself, his body. He wrote in free verse, you know, whereas the poets prior to him had been sticking to the European forms. So it's beautiful to see how America has contributed. You know, when we see these different forms of artistic expression happening as a result of being American, I just love what you say about it made you patriotic.
Yeah.
Not only to experience it, but my goodness, now you are part of creating it, which has got to be what a honor that you must feel.
It really is an honor, and I feel like you do your best work. Like, I always want to do my best work, but there's this legacy that you're carrying forward. And so that really, you're carrying kind of your ancestors with you. And so you're never creating alone, which I think is really wonderful, but there are points of reference. And so there's decisions, choreographic decisions of, do I want to go with this or do I want to counter this? And that there's both are fine.
And evolution like this is inevitable. What about the major modern dancers, including Martha Graham? Were they happy to see some of their younger dancers move on and express themselves maybe a little bit differently? Or was there angst within the dancing profession?
I think it was both. I think it's hard. There's such an investment in your dancers. There's such a trust. Martha Graham really understood that this was necessary. And this is what made it different from ballet, is that it had to evolve. You had to think of those next generations coming up. And so one of the ways for her to do that was to use her resources to help her dancers advance. And that same opportunity that Martha Graham gave to Elisa Monte, Elisa Monte gave to me.
And certainly physicality has got to be one of the terms that you would use as far as modern dance is concerned. I mean, some of this, some of the movements are just so athletic that you see now. So that would be one characteristic. What other words would you use to characterize modern dance now?
I would say it's very grounded. It's very virtuosic, as you said. What I find really wonderful about modern dance specifically is modern dance partnering. It has a lot of weight and counterweight. It has a lot of off-centeredness versus what you would see in ballet, which is everything's very
uniform,
much on its center. And your partner's center has to be lined up with your center. So there's, you know, it's like that wow factor when you're in the audience and you like gasp. I think that's what modern dance does, because in what it is, it's meant to push and be on the cutting edge. And so for those, hopefully, that are doing it correctly, that's the experience that the audience walks away with.
So you followed Elisa Monte. You are the first artistic director past Elisa Monte, the originator. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What an incredible honor that's got to feel like, yeah?
It is, and it was a surprise.
Well, let's talk about your life. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, and then at three, my family moved to California, and I lived in a couple of different places in California. But I always danced. I started dancing since I was three, and I just loved it. And as I was a very physical child, so I did lots of sports, but as my time got less and less that I could dedicate, dance was always the priority. I had never met any professional dancers. I thought it was a hobby. I didn't know you could make a career out of it. A lot of people from my personal studio, they went on to become like Laker girls or 49er girls, and I didn't want to be a cheerleader. So for me, I just thought I would do it as long as I can, and then I would go study business and enter the corporate sector and do that.
So then high school, then college. Where did you go to college?
I went to Purchase College, SUNY Purchase,
a
conservatory
program.
How did
you get from one coast to the other? SUNY Purchase, for those people who don't understand, we're using the term SUNY, which is State University of New York, and there's many of them dotted throughout the state, but Purchase is a town north of New York City. So how did you get from California turned you then to purchase New York?
Through dance. I found out one of my friends from my local dance school, their mom told my mom, I think that she's good enough to get into a conservatory. And I had no idea what a conservatory was. I didn't know that you could dance in college. And so my mom and I just started going to work looking this idea of like conservatories and actually studying dance as a career. And Purchase was having, their very last audition of the season was in person. So my mom and I flew to New York. I did the whole audition with my leg bent because I couldn't straighten it yet. But I got in, which was amazing. I told the adjudicators, they knew that I was coming off of surgery, and they were like, you know, take it easy. And I didn't. It was just worth it. Like, it was worth breaking my body in hopes to make the dream possibly happen.
Right. Hmm? Yeah. Okay, so you were at SUNY Purchase then for 4-year program?
Yes.
Okay, and then what did you do after that?
One of my professors would do performances every now and then with professionals in New York. His name was Kevin Nguyen, and it was like anyone that was anyone danced for Kevin. He was always their first entry into the modern dance, or like into professional world. When I was in California, the type of dance that I did was competition dancing. So it wasn't until I got to Purchase that I had heard about Martha Graham, that I heard about Jose Limon. Like, I had no idea, Paul Taylor. I didn't know these names.
Sure.
And so I was 17. I was in New York. I didn't know anyone. So I went to the library and I just like looked up like modern dance and like modern dance founders. And I fell in love with it. And so by the end of my 4 years there, I was hooked. And I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And sure enough, Kevin did hire me, and the summer of my senior year, I did Lincoln Center Outdoors, and there was someone in the audience that saw me, invited me to come to an audition, and I went to Cyprus, and that was my first that was my second professional job, actually, because I had done a work study or a exchange program my senior year. And at the end of that program, that was in Burgos, Spain, all of my academics were done. So I literally just came back, performed my senior solo, and was able to graduate. So that was my first professional job. After that, Lincoln Center, and then to
Cyprus. Off to Cyprus. And how long were you on Cyprus?
6 months. Mm-hmm. I was in. And that one was a tough job because it was basically the Cypriot Broadway. So I didn't understand what a toll it takes to do the same show 8 times a week. And it started breaking down my body. Mm-hmm. And I think at that time, too, I just started missing home. I wanted to come home and be a normal person. So I came back to the States, and I couldn't afford New York City prices. So I lived in Jersey City. And I made the sweeping declaration, and I told all my friends, I was like, I'm going to be a waitress. Like, that's what I wanted to do, because I needed a second to step away from dancing to see if I wanted to do it here. One, because dancing in Europe is very different from dancing in the States financially. So I had money, and I could bank money. That was my job. I didn't have a secondary job. It's a very different lifestyle. They understood that this was your job. In the United States, not so much. So I really said, I'm going to take a break. And if it really calls to me again, then I'm going to jump back in. But I'm not going to jump back in to do this just because it's what I've always done. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had other talents. And if that was as far as my dance career was going to take me, it already exceeded my expectations. So it's like, great. And then, or the regulars would ask, like, so what do you do? Because most people that are in their 20s are not career waiters or waitresses. Mm-hmm. And I would say, I'm a dancer. And they'd be like, great. When's your show? When's your next show coming up? And I didn't have one. Mm-hmm. And you can only get asked that so many times before I had to ask myself, like, are you a dancer? And so I had to sit with that question. And I was like, I'm not a dancer right now, I don't think, but I want to be.
Good.
So onto the audition circuit I went.
What I am interested in is, you know, you are much more than a dancer now. I mean, you are a creator. So did you recognize your creative ability at that pre-waitress dancing career that you had? Or was that something that all of a sudden you realized, wait a second, I've got something to say? Did that come later?
Yeah, that came much later. That came much later, and reluctantly so. I was very reluctant to become a creator. I think what Europe allowed me to do is to understand that this is a business at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And you need a structure to support the arts. And so I thought when I stopped dancing that I would go into the back end in administration just to make sure the dancers were paid on time. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I became really passionate about, was like building up these structures in the States so that dancers could have an experience like mm-hmm. I had, that they could get paid, you know, on the 15th and 30th of every month and, mm-hmm. and not have it be a question mark whether you're going to get paid for your work. And so I had never considered being a choreographer.
Mm-hmm. So back to the audition circuit, then you were hired right away then, is that correct?
I was, mm-hmm. yeah. I had a couple of friends that were in Elisa's company, and I would talk to them, and one of my friends in the company said, you should come to the audition. Like, Elisa's going to be at Steps on Broadway. She's going to do a workshop. You should show up. I think that you'll really like it. At that point, I think everything was just kind of aligning, and I needed to take the safety net away from myself. So I went first in the audition. There were 75 women there for one spot.
Oh.
It narrowed down to 4. And that's because it wasn't publicly, like, usually there would be many more. It was just
many
that
more
it,
spots or many more dancers?
Many more dancers.
Yes.
Yeah, 75 is not large.
So then you got the job, of course, and then you were with Elisa Monte Dance for how many years?
I danced with Elisa for 13 years, like, as her principal lead dancer before becoming her associate artistic director.
I see. And so just give us an idea of where it took you throughout the world.
Oh, geez. We went everywhere. We went to Italy and France quite a bit. And we were all throughout Great Britain and Brazil. I met my husband in the company. Mm-hmm. I was proposed to on tour. Our best man was in the company. Like, it really changed my life.
So then is there a home base for Elisa Monte in New York City?
Yes, we are based in Harlem. We rent out different studios, so we don't have a studio home, but we have an administrative home. And then our second home is actually this Lake Placid Center for the Arts, and has been for over 30 years, mm-hmm. which is amazing. So we've kind of always operated in dual spaces, but with the last 3 years, I think with me taking over the directorship of the school too, and with James Lemons coming in as the director there, we've really established that this is a second home.
And here so in Lake Placid.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's great. All right. Well, there we go. We got you up here. And then, of course, you were shining in the troupe to the point where she felt that you would be good as her assistant artistic director then.
Yes.
And why don't we talk about that? How did that, she saw your artistic ability then. And had you been giving ideas? Had you been ad-libbing on stage? And her seeing that and saying, hey, actually, I kind of like that.
You know, I think one thing, I think she saw my work ethic is that I'm a creature of repetition, and I don't like being late. So I would show up early and I would start rehearsing. And so I would rehearse, and then afterwards I would stay late and work on my notes. So I think that she saw hard work. I went to the gym before rehearsal. Like, I would go to the gym for like 2 hours. I would go to a warm-up class, then we would rehearse for 5 hours. Then I would go to like a yoga class or something to calm, like to...
My goodness.
Yeah, I mean, it's a full... I was like, but outside of that, I could come in and just organize or just be another set of hands. And she said, great. And so I just started working in the office. Mm-hmm. And I think the hard work that she saw mixed with a real passion to understand the workings, the behind the scenes workings of like how you run a dance company, mixed with the reviews that I got, mm-hmm. I think she was like, okay, we found something here.
So was she ready to just to turn it over to you at the time, or did she put out any feelers for anyone else to take over as artistic director?
It was a surprise. She just said, you know, I don't know when this is going to happen, but whenever I retire, I want you to have the company. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know how to take that. I wasn't prepared mm-hmm. for that in any way, but I do like a challenge. Mm-hmm. And I believed in her work.
Before we get into your artistic expression and hers and how you are simpatico with her or you have your own voice, you're certainly an individual who has a story to tell. But let's just talk about dance in general. What is it that's so enthralling or inspiring or artistic? Can you tell me about that? What is it about dance as an art form that an audience should or is the opportunity for them to experience?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things. It's a wonderful mix because you have a lot of times you're working with like live music, you have a costume design, so you're working with fashion, you're working with lighting design, you're creating an environment and you're creating an escape. So with that, you can just dive into beauty and allow the escapism to come in. You can approach really tough questions and break it down in a way that is abstract yet tangible. So for me, I really hope that when the patron leaves, that they are altered in any way, whether it's they're happier than when they came in, whether they're feeling more pensive or more curious than when they came in. But I think it's about the journey. And those that come to dance, I think, are a special breed because you sit down and you don't really know what's going to happen. So you already have to be on the curious side because it is an abstract art form. What happens is so magical because it's that cast in that place with that audience. And because I've done things over and over and over, it really is that makeup of people. The next night, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And I want people to enjoy the experience. And I think that's what I like about the abstraction of it, is that you can insert yourself in it. You can see yourself in it. I've presented works and people have like many different interpretations of what it is. And the answer is yes, it's all of those things. But it gets you thinking and it gets you feeling if done right. I don't think that people leave unaltered. Mm-hmm. You don't leave the same way you came in.
Well, as an audience member, I've definitely gone through an evolution growing up in a religious environment. It took me a while to be able to admit to myself, that is a beautiful body, even
yeah.
Male, female and male.
Absolutely.
And so that was one hurdle I had to get over. Mm-hmm. And then that other hurdle was okay, well, what's going on here?
Right.
Are they just jumping around and running around?
Right.
No, they look to me like, wait a minute, there's communication going on between these two dancers. Then I began feeling stupid, you know, because I didn't know what they're saying because they're not telling me what they're saying. And so they obviously are wanting to get something across to me. So would you say that modern dance really is storytelling and that it's important for an audience member to sit there and to understand exactly what is being told? Or is it okay for the audience member to just to sit there like any other piece of art and get out of it what they individually get out of, which might be something different than the person sitting next to them, whether they're looking at an oil painting or whether they're looking at a group of dancers?
Yeah, the latter. I now, because of that exact thing and so many, I think that modern dance sometimes loses an audience because people are intimidated by it. They're like, well, I didn't get it, so I'm not going to come back. And so I've started doing curtain speeches saying exactly that. Like, you're going to get out of it whatever you get out of it, and great. And I say, like, if there is a one thing for you to get, I'll tell you at the beginning so then you can be like, got it, or didn't. But if there's not, if it's open to multiple interpretations, which it usually is, and that's the beauty of it. So instead of being intimidated by that, it's like, yeah, just let it wash over you. Mm-hmm. Grab what you can. Don't worry about what you can't. And if you really, you know, come back tomorrow and see it again and see,
right,
you know, see what that is. But that's part of the art going experience. And I think it's a really beautiful part.
Well, I do too. So what about you? Is there a message that you want to get across? Are you on a journey yourself to tell a story as an artist? And can you do that through Elisa Monte?
I do feel like I'm perfectly set up with the vehicle that I have to be able to tell a story. So right now, the pieces that I'm working with are very historically based. I have a dance film that is a kind of what if around Timbuktu and John Brown Farm and John Brown. I have a piece about the centennial of the Harlem Renaissance and the 1920s talking to the 2020s and what that conversation is. There's talk that we are in a Black Renaissance right now. And so what is the Black Renaissance versus the Harlem Renaissance? And like, what does that conversation look like? I'm also about to start a commission with the Dance Theater of Harlem about Hazel Scott, the musician Hazel Scott. So that those things anchor me in history, and I think through those three pieces, what I want the audience to walk away with is, like, in the best and worst way, we haven't evolved that much. So if these are questions that came up 100 years ago and we're still asking these same questions, what's the work that needs to be done to get us to the end? As I delved into what was happening during the Harlem Renaissance, as I was delving into Hazel Scott's life, as I was delving into John Brown, this idea of just shared humanity comes back again and again and again. And I think for me, that's all of my pieces at some point have that at their core.
Beautiful. Yeah. Well, this is perfect for From the Hip Radio, because those of those people out there who have heard previous podcasts know that one of the themes that runs through this is we're all in this together, you know, as Americans, how divided we are right now. I really believe that the division is the storm before the calm. You know, I think that we have to go through this storm and we have to be woke up. And so what you're doing is a major part of that. So let's talk about race for just a moment. As a black woman, is there a problem following a white woman in the Elisa Monte dance troupe? Is that a dynamic at all? Or Elisa Monte has always been integrated.
Yeah, not from Elisa. I will say that. You know, when Elisa started this company in 1981, it was a place for black dancers to get work. There weren't a lot of dance companies that were hiring black dancers. So having diversity within, and not only racial diversity, but geographic, we always had people from other countries. Like, it was always something that was important. When I was doing, like, the interview circuit, when it was announced that I was taking over, the first question that I always get asked is, like, well, is it a black dance company now? And the first time I got asked, it really threw me. It really, really threw me. And so what I realized at the end of the day was, like, that's, I'm not going to answer that question, because that's allowing your, that's me allowing you to put me in a box.
Right.
And so what I would say is, like, it depends on how you define a black dance company. If you think that a black dance company is made up because you see black bodies on stage, then no, it wouldn't be a black dance company. But if you define a black dance company by any, that the person that's creating it is a black person, so anything that I make is black, then yes, I'm going to make work because I'm an artist, and I'm going to make my work. And I'm going to continue this legacy of diversity. I don't think that there's major changes I'm making now, other than I am really making sure that, as we talked about earlier, that modern dance is a reaction to the now. So I think me being a black woman leading this company now is imperative. I think that it's really, really important.
I agree. I that was a good answer. I read an article that you recently wrote called Calling in Black, and it was a very interesting article. Calling in Black, you were relating it to calling in sick, that within your company that your dancers have the option to be able to call in black. Could you explain what that means?
Sure. Basically, it was during the time of Trayvon Martin, and it was me and another black staffer that were working at Elisa Monte Dance. And he is a black male, and he called in and he just said, you know, I'm terrified to leave my house. And it was clear he had been crying. And I said, don't worry about it. Like, just stay home. Just don't worry about it. Like, I was scared as well. And in that time, there was no one from the organization, like, checking in. There was no acknowledgement. There was no one. I'm like, this was a kid. This was a kid. And there is, you know, this has been happening since the beginning of this country. And that you wear that every day. And I was like, this is not okay. Like, it's not okay to feel like this. And so basically calling in black just allows for time, if something happens to a specific group, to just take a beat. One, to check on them and say, how are you doing? What do you need? How can I support you? And if they are not going to do their best work, to just allow them to take that day, because it is a sickness. Like, racism is a sickness. And so therefore it is like taking a sick day.
Was it met positively?
Oh, absolutely. It's never been abused. It's never been abused.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right. I had talked to you about my evolution as a privileged white male as I've gone through my own life. It not only pertains to my relationship with people other than my white race, but also in my maleness. Mm-hmm. This term paternalism, when it's logical that women are equal to men,
right.
There's no doubt about it, but I'm not doing anything about it. As a matter of fact, I would talk to women differently than I would talk to men in a situation because I'm less threatened by the woman than I am the man.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
And it took an evolution. Now I hope that I'm at the point where I'm not only saying that women are equal to men, but I'm also practicing that. But it's this sense of superiority that a person has. When I began to look at the plight of the black person, I used to think, oh, those poor people, you know, I'm going to have to do something for those people. Mm-hmm. You carry that sense of superiority, which can even be worse than racism, because at least they, you know, someone who's a racist, you know what they,
you know what you're working with.
You know what you're working with.
Yes.
But when a guy comes in, you know, who has this paternalism thing, and I can say this without being embarrassed because it was just the evolution. I had earlier before the broadcast, I talk about my Catholicism. Mm-hmm. There was a point in my life where I really believed that only Catholics were going to go to heaven. Believed it so much, though, that I was coming home from a dinner that I was invited to when I was about 10, 11, 12 years old, maybe 10 years old, at Terry Raffensperger's house on Grand Court. I know exactly where I was at the moment when I said to myself, isn't it too bad that Terry can't go to heaven? What a nice guy he is in his family. But I just took it for granted that they weren't going to heaven. It's this sense of superiority that I had as a male, I had as a Catholic, I had as a white person. Mm-hmm. And Nina Simone's song, Mississippi Goddamn, where she says in there, you don't have to live next to me. Just give me equality and I'll take it from there. Mm-hmm. And me realizing that, you know, I really have been stifling the growth of women in the world because of this paternalism I had toward women. Non-Catholics because of my paternalism as a Catholic. The progression of black people has been stifled because of my paternalism, thinking that I was superior to them. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that term paternalism? And is it as real as what I'm trying to explain?
No, it's very real. And I think it's a term that everyone should get very familiar with because it has real life effects. And I don't know that people understand the real life effects, but I think that you laid it out beautifully. And I think one of the ways, it's a learned behavior, number one. And I think people have to understand that you're not born into this world with any thought in your head. They are put there. And one of the reasons I think it is learned is because people are afraid to talk about race. So for me, I grew up on the West Coast and Californians love to not see color. That's like their favorite. It's like, oh, I don't see color. And I had to stop people in the most respectful way because I understood what they were trying to say. But I'm like, if you don't see color, that means you don't see me. And I want to be very clear about that because I'm very proud to be a black woman. And so I don't want you to pretend like I'm something else. I don't want to have to be something else for you to imagine me within your world. I want you to be able to look and see me and be curious about that and have us have an open conversation about that. I will never understand and know whiteness. I will never know and understand Asianness. And that's fine. But how you will learn and understand those things is one, through actual conversation. And two, I mean, we're so lucky to live in the age that we do because most of us are walking around with a full-on computer that has the entire internet in it. You know, so we have the ability to kind of leap forward in a really expansive ways that those before us didn't. We had to wait and only get from one side once it was written down and someone was published. And like we got to hear only from those that were chosen. And so what about those that were not chosen? Like, it doesn't make those stories any less relevant. You can't see me, but like, I am a 5'1", very small black woman who looks very young. So people think that I'm younger than I am. And so there's actual paternalism as it place of like, oh, she's a cute little girl. Like, there's that, you know, and it's fine for me. I look, it's only going to be to your detriment that you underestimate me. I think it's important for all of us to evaluate, like, what do our privileges, how do our privileges affect others? I think at the end of the day is what it is, because do I ask the person that I'm providing service to what they need, or do I assume that I know what you need because, like, I'm a good person because I do service work, mm-hmm. right? And, like, that's the thing. I think you always have to invite people into the room. So even, like, with my dancers, I am their boss. There is an actual hierarchy there. I'm much older than all of them. But I still bring them when I'm making decisions about my company's in the room. And I think that that's one way to get around this is, like, whatever action that you're doing for others, make sure that it is, you know, vetted and approved by those people, because that's a good way. And then you're lots of time you'll be like, oh, because things that we might be up like racking our brain for might be like right at the tip of the tongue for someone else because it's their lived experience. That's it. And I think we, if we can go back to like what we were talking about of that, this shared humanity, we all come into the world the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love talking about race relations, and when I could never figure out when they said, I don't see color, because I didn't even have to evolve into that one. I did not, because I says, I see color.
Yeah.
I definitely see color.
Yeah.
And I not only do I see color, but then I jump in because I'm so interested mm-hmm. in it. I agree. There's nothing wrong
right.
with saying I do see color.
Yeah.
And so I'm so glad that you explained it the way you did. All right. Well, what about the future for you? What's happening now? You will be with Elisa Monte for a while. Do you find yourself, having a Tiffany Ray Fisher dance troupe?
I mean, I feel artistically I'm able to do everything I need to with Elisa mm-hmm. Monte Dance. I did start another organization with my husband a couple of years ago, and it's a service organization that helps emerging artists in dance, theater, music, and film. So, but there's nothing wanting, me starting, I would just be doing what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
but with less resources.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
I also curate the Bryant Park Fall Festival, and that allows me to give opportunity for young artists and to put them on the New York scene in a really big way. So there's lots of things I teach all the time. I teach and do lectures in universities, but I also teach like dance classes. So I think I like having my hands in lots of different pots because it keeps me honest, it keeps me grounded, and it lets me understand what this next generation of dance is going to be, because at the end of the day, I'm going to get older and the dancers are going to stay somewhere between the 20s and 30s. My life is really fulfilled now, and there's nothing kind of missing because I didn't categorize it in like, I'm going to be a this, which is only this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm going to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And within that artistry is writing, is political organizing, is volunteering, is creating, is administering, it's all of those things. So I think keeping an open definition is something that's helpful to me. So, I'm going to work that schedule until I can't anymore.
Yeah.
Because, like, while I'm here and I have the energy to do it, why not?
Why not do it?
Yeah.
That's cool. Oh, one other question I want to ask. What about the career of a dancer? Not all dancers get to go on to be artistic directors and creators like you have.
Right.
A lot of their careers, unfortunately, end at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say someone who's in high school right now mm-hmm. wanting to become a professional dancer. What advice would you give that young man or young woman about how to prepare themselves for the world?
I think, one of them, it's like, I'm glad that I'm being asked this question by you, is like, you have to get your team together. You have to get your medical team together. Like, who's going to keep you on stage? We've learned a lot about the body, and we've learned a lot about the kind of body, soul, mind connection, like a holistic view of the body. And I think artistic directors and choreographers, I believe, and I hope it's going this way, are really looking to take care of the whole person in a way that earlier on that was not the case. You kind of burnt out and went through dancers as bodies broke down. So the career of the dancer is expanding. It's really important because you have an opportunity now to have a 20 plus year career, which just wasn't a thing. Really having a strong knowledge of your body and finding a trusted team to work with you that you can grow with, I think is crucial.
Great. Is there anything else that you would like to say regarding any of the topics that we've brought up today?
I think I feel very good about everything. I think at the end of the day, I'm just very hopeful. Like, I have a lot of hope for the future of our world. I have a lot of hope for the future of the arts. And I think it's just important for young people. It's like whatever that thing is that you want to do. I didn't have this life. I didn't know this life could exist until I had it. And so I think continuing to be optimistic as we come out of this kind of COVID bubble and reopening, I think is really important. And to enter into whatever field that you're going to do or whatever stage of life, whether it's entering into high school, whether it's entering into the workforce, to do so audaciously. And I think that's
beautiful.
What I will say.
Well, you have such a busy schedule, and I once again have to tell you how I feel honored to be able to have you take time out of your day to come here and chat with me about these things that are very important to me. So Tiffany Ray Fisher, thank you so much.
My
appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was wonderful. Thank you, Joe.
You're welcome.
And again, you can learn more about the Elisa Monte Dance Company and more on the impressive resume of Tiffany Ray Fisher at the website elisamontedance.org. And that's Bette Midler with Do You Wanna Dance? Now, way back in 1983, October 12th, as a matter of fact, the Talking Heads were scheduled to perform in Charlottesville, Virginia. I was living 45 minutes away in Stanton at the time, but since it was a Wednesday night, we were not sure if we wanted to make a late night of it. I did have to work at 7 a.m. the next morning. It was a phone call from Clayton and John Griffin encouraging us to go that eventually motivated us. And we did not realize at the time that this would be a night of history making. You see, this was the tour to support their new album, Speaking in Tongues. But the tour would forever become known as the Stop Making Sense Tour after a movie of the same name came out that simply recorded the show from beginning to end, nothing more. After experiencing that show just like us, but in another town, the movie producer Jonathan Demme was convinced that this concert needed to be documented. He quickly made arrangements with the band, and thankfully the tour had more dates for the filming to take place. And I know just how that guy felt. I've never been to a show where the band had such control over all the audience. No one was sitting. All the way up to the rafters, the people were standing. all with hips shaking, heads bopping, and shoulders swaying. It was as if we were all in a trance, possessed by the genius of David Byrne and company. I'll keep the dance theme going and give you an idea of what we experienced that night. From the movie Stop Making Sense, here's the Talking Heads with Life During Wartime.
Burning gives me a lie.
Oh, yeah, that was quite a show. Now, I have always loved rockabilly music, especially that twangy guitar sound. So here's a throwback for you. Certainly adheres to the dancing theme of today's show. Robert Gordon on vocals, Link Wray on guitar with Eddie Cochran's 20 Flight Rock.
Ooh, well, I got a gal with a wrecking machine. When it comes to rocking, she is a queen. We love to dance on Saturday night, alone where I can hold her tight. But she lives on the 28th floor uptown. The elevator's broken down. So I walk 1, 2, flight, 3, flight, 4, 5, 6, 7, flight, 8, flight, more. I'm on a 12, I'm starting to drag. 15 at the floor and I'm ready to sag. Get to the top, I'm too tired to rock. Well, she calling me up on the telephone. Said, come on over, honey, I'm all alone. I said, baby, you're mighty sweet, but I'm in bed with the aching feet. This went on for a couple of days, but I couldn't stay away. So I walked 1, 2, flight, 3, flight, 4, 5, 6, 7, flight, 8, flight, more. I'm on a 12, I'm starting to drag. 15 to 4 and I'm ready to sag. Get to the top, I'm too tired to rock.
Yeah!
I sent to Chicago for a pairs. Two lipsticks, I'm using the stairs. Hope to hurry before it's too late. I love my baby too much to wait. All this climbing is getting me down. To find my corpse draped over a rail. So I climb 1, 2, flight, 3, flight, 4. 5, 6, 7, flight, 8, flight, more. Up on the 12, I'm starting to drag. 15, 4, and I'm ready to sag. Get to the top, I'm too tired to rock.
Robert Gordon and Link Wray with 20 Flight Rock. And now, we just can't have a dance theme without some klezmer music. It's just so joyful. So here are the Klezmatics with Chava Elberstein joining Lauren Sklomberg on vocals with Ovent Lid. Now, I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it. As a matter of fact, this song may not even be joyful. I wouldn't know. I don't understand Yiddish. Oh well, I sure do love this music.
Ressort a temple, ressort a kleisel, wer's besucht a schenkel, wer a freilich heisel, wer bes muss man hoppen, eine muss man gläuben, sie a teufel unten, sie a gott dort oben, wer bes muss man hoppen, eine muss man gläuben, sie a teufel unten, sie a gott dort oben.
Wer es hat der Tempo, wer es hat der Kleise, wer es besucht der Schenkel, wer a freile Kaisel, das muss man haben, nein, das muss man gläuben, sie hat Teibel unten, sie hat Gott dort oben, das muss man haben, nein, das muss man gläuben, sie hat Teibel unten, sie hat Gott dort oben.
Verhassen wirst du wie kein Blondchen in die Gassen.
And that's it for our dance-themed podcast number 12. I sure hope you enjoyed it. And remember, you can contact me with any comments or suggestions at fromthehipradio@gmail.com. I'll sign off now with the smooth groove of Cuban-American Chico Alvarez with Val Carretera. See you all next week.
Cantares de mi pueblo. siembra la caña, el guajiro con su maña hace que el fruto resuma. Allá en la vestre campiña, donde nacen marañones, cosechan ricos melones, dulces y sabrosas piñas. La palma en el verde llano al son del tiempo se mece, son que alegra y fortalece el orgullo del cubano.
En Guajira escuchar los cantares de mi Cuba,
junto al rumoroso río, sentina la caña brava.